This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago, and our speaker today was United States Congressman Representative Peter Roskam, whose district represents the west suburbs and well up into the northwest suburbs like Barrington. Congressman Roskam spoke about six issues. Number one, tax reform. He said, we're either going to fix things in 2017 or we won't do it at all. Then he spoke about the Affordable Care Act, and he said we must replace it and not fix it because it would be a political ploy to simply fix it. The party, the Republican Party, campaigned on repeal, and he feels we must honor that campaign promise. He was asked about the town hall meetings, which he is not a fan of because there have been many demonstrators, and he said we want civility in public life, so he will not hold public town hall meetings. He's also opposed to any religious admissions as a test for admission to the United States. That question was asked by a representative of the American Civil Liberties Union. Another question that he was asked was, should elected officials be required to release their tax returns? And he said, definitely not. If we wanted them to release tax returns, it would be in the tax reform code. And then finally, he was asked a number of questions about President Donald Trump and his working with the House. And he said, I believe that Trump is looking to the House to put meat on the bone for his programs, but we're learning an awful lot about unexpressed thoughts.
Well, thank you very much. I asked Rodney Davis, did you lose a bet or something? Is that that's why you're here today? But thank you for coming. So Rodney's going to field the questions at the end of our time today. So about a year ago or so, I had the opportunity to attend a conference in China. And when you're an American policymaker and you go to China, you get a bunch of briefings about how great China is. And I went over and we spent time in Beijing and we spent time in Nanjing. And I came back and I was a little bit counterintuitive. Now, I'm not here to dump on China. But I came back and I thought, we've got challenges. They've got troubles. And I would much rather have challenges than troubles any day of the week. So here's China's troubles. Their one-child policy is out of sync. Their pollution is unbelievable. They've bitten off more than they can chew in the South China Sea. They can't control Kim Jong-un on the Korean Peninsula. Their economic rights are out of sync with their political rights. They're on the verge of a personality cult with their President Xi that is taking on, who's taking on incredible power. And I landed at O'Hare and I thought, this place is great. I was so happy to be home. Now, I'm not here pumping sunshine. I'm not here telling you that we don't have some very serious things to deal with. But in this great scheme of things, I think the serious things that we have to deal with can be seriously dealt with. Let me describe to you an observation about our tax code and why I think we are at a national inflection point, particularly as it relates to the tax policy that we have. We've got a tax code that is not working for us. Interestingly, nobody is defending the current tax code. Nobody in this room is defending the current tax code. Go talk to anybody on the street, say, what do you think about the Internal Revenue Code? You will get no defenders of it. They like certain elements of it, but nobody likes the whole thing, which is interesting. That means inflection point. The second thing is we've seen the shine come off the penny of the Internal Revenue Service. It can be the targeting issues. It can be abuse as it relates to civil asset forfeiture, which I think we talked about last time that I was here. It can be just the core competency issues as it relates to the Internal Revenue Service. But what was a reputation 20 years ago of being tough but fair, they don't have that reputation today, and they don't deserve that reputation today. So you're at a national inflection point in terms of complexity of the code. You've got the enforcement agency that nobody trusts, basically. And then finally, the inversions of American companies is continuing to happen, which is actually incredibly unsettling. So what does that mean? When Aon left Chicagoland, Aon left Chicago as their headquarters, but they didn't go to some tax jurisdiction somewhere. They went to the UK. Or similarly, when Burger King left, they didn't go to some tax haven somewhere. They went to Canada. So this sense of us trying to deal with this has not been successful. And this is due in part to our tax code. There's also similar problems in terms of intellectual property that is placed outside of the United States. And why is all of this happening? It's happening because of our own tax code. So what I'm describing is essentially a national inflection point where I think there is energy and there is a focal point that says, let's have a transformational moment and let's update this code. And there is a buoyancy to that. And if we do it and we do it in the right way and we don't jam this through, but do it in a way where a lot of people have a lot of input, then I think over a period of time, it can be incredibly significant. But lest you think that this is for the faint of heart, let me just describe a quick phone call that I had when I first got on the Ways and Means Committee. This is a few years ago, and tax reform was kind of in the air. So I thought, well, I'm going to ask the person who is really in the middle of tax reform, because it's been a generation since it happened. 1986 was the last big tax push. So I called James Baker of James Baker fame. And got him on the phone and asked him some questions and back and forth. And he was incredibly generous with me in terms of anecdotes and insights and all sorts of strategies and so forth. But at the end, he said something that I still remember, and let me repeat it to you. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But he said, Peter, remember, tax reform in 1986 was Ronald Reagan's number one domestic priority of his second term. He used everything that he had as Ronald Reagan. We used everything at the White House. We used everything at the Treasury Department. We had powerful, bipartisan, bicameral sponsors on Capitol Hill, and it collapsed three times, and it almost didn't happen. Hey, got to run. Talk to you soon. All right, so there's a little bit of that was then and this is now. And I think that was then and this is now is based on this inflection, based on this idea that this is so complicated to the point of distraction. Let me make one other quick point, particularly about intellectual property that's getting placed overseas. We've been trying, you know, there's been a number of attempts that House Republicans have tried to deal with this, all with no success, coming up with complicated tax rules and really intricate things that, when it all came down to it, didn't do the trick. The Obama administration tried a different approach. They tried to change rules under what's known as Section 385, Treasury regulations, which were redefining 40 years of doctrine as it relates to debt and equity definitions. That didn't work. And the more time I've spent on this issue, that is, that intellectual property and profits are shifting overseas, the more I've come to the conclusion that you think of this as a basement that you're trying to patch. I can't figure out a way to patch the basement. And every other attempt to try and patch the basement, whether it's been on the Republican side or the Democratic side, have all ended up just incredibly underperforming. So the name of the game, in my view, fill the basement in and dig a new foundation. Now, this notion of fundamental tax reform is really worth sinking our teeth in and trying to get done. Because I'm of the opinion if we get this done in 2017, then the United States becomes the most attractive tax jurisdiction in the world. The United States is the place where people want to come for all the reasons that I argued a couple of minutes ago about China's troubles. The challenge of fixing our tax code and making it competitive can be incredibly inviting. And that's the sort of renaissance that I think a lot of folks are really hungry for. My opinion is this, and this is a political observation. We will either fix this in 2017 or we won't do it at all. I think this happens in 2017 or it doesn't happen. And there is a, think of the current tax code as essentially an island that's dissolving underneath us. And if we are under the illusion that we can stay on this island, we're foolish. It will not last. This thing is not lasting. We are losing from an international point of view, and we're never going to get closer than we are right now to jump to something new. This is as sure-footed as we are right now, and we've got to jump while there's an opportunity to jump. Okay, so what's the plan? What's the proposal? Back when Paul Ryan became Speaker of the House, and if you're a person of faith, pray for Paul Ryan. Toughest job in American politics, no doubt about it. So when Ryan became the Speaker, he realized that one of the weaknesses of the House Republican majority was not communicating essentially an aspirational vision. So he said, here's what we're going to do. He went to the various committees of Congress and he said, Ways and Means, we want you to come up with a plan as it relates to tax reform. We want to come up with an approach on health care. We want to come up with an approach on energy, on financial services, and all these different areas that are so consequential to us. So a blueprint was crafted, and a blueprint was published in the middle of the summer. The original thinking was these blueprints and these themes will be, referendum questions in the fall campaign, and people will talk about them and then come back and they'll be enacted. None of that happened, of course. The fall campaign was completely eclipsed by Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and pushed out every other really substantive policy discussion because of these two incredible figures that were fighting for the White House. But then a funny thing happened, and that was the election of Donald Trump. So all of a sudden, people were looking on election night, and the next morning, particularly if you're a tax lobbyist in Washington, D.C., and you're downloading the House Republican blueprint, saying, what is in this thing? Because all of a sudden, this becomes a foundational document upon which the discussion of tax reform is happening. Now, any observer of Capitol Hill knows that just because the House proposes something doesn't mean that the Senate accepts something. But you take my point that this is essentially an invitation, essentially the beginning of a proposal. So here's what we've said. We need to have a couple of core themes. And as I articulate these core themes, remember, you can walk away from any of these. You can say, you know what, that part, that number four or number three or whatever, that's not important. You can walk away from those, but you get a fundamentally different approach. And I think the four things are going to be attractive to you. So let me try you out. The first is growth. We need a competitive tax code that is creating growth, and the growth has to be significant. Many people who have looked at the blueprint in totality, for example, Larry Lindsey, who was Ronald Reagan's economist or one of the key people involved in the 1981 Reagan approach as it relates to taxes, has described the blueprint as jet fuel for the economy. So growth is important. Another thing that's important is simplicity. 70,000 pages, or in the words of former chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, longer than the Bible with none of the good news. That is the Internal Revenue Code. So we got 70,000 pages, internal things that are wildly inconsistent, definitions that are inconsistent, and essentially a hodgepodge of tax policy that doesn't do anybody any good. So that's the second thing, simplicity. The third thing is, and I'll reiterate this, competitiveness in terms of attracting capital. And that's dealing with this intellectual property issue, that's dealing with $2 trillion U.S. dollars that's currently locked out, known as the locked out effect, because we're the only large economy in the world that has what's known as an international tax system. We need to move, like the rest of the world, to a territorial system. And then the fourth component is very important, I think, and we know this in Illinois all too well. The fourth component is that it has to be revenue neutral. Now, let me just describe a couple of these choices as it relates to revenue neutrality. There's two ways to define this, and they're incongruous in a way. One way to define revenue neutrality is absurd, in my view. It's called static scoring. Okay, how does static scoring work? Static scoring is scoring or a measurement of revenue proposals that says there's no change in policy or there's no change in behavior no matter what the tax policy is. Okay, it's just ridiculous. In other words, it says you can raise taxes to any level and the same level of economic activity is going to happen. Okay, we know that's just not true. And yet that's the way historically Washington has scored things. There's another way to score things, and that's dynamic scoring. Dynamic scoring says, all right, presume changes in behavior or changes in policy mean changes in behavior. That's a lot more intuitive. There's an inherent criticism of dynamic scoring, though, in that there's a temptation to make it economic pixie dust, to just sort of make it up. Well, there's good modeling that the Tax Foundation has done. There's good modeling that now the House, the Joint Committee on Taxation and the Congressional Budget Office are doing. But you can see where dynamic scoring can be used and can be manipulated. It's sort of like if you're pitching a new program down in Springfield and you've got no money, you just say, well, I'm going to propose it through natural revenue growth, which should be banned from all discussions in the state legislature. But you take my point. This notion of revenue neutrality. Now, why does this matter? This matters because the United States is $20 trillion in debt. This matters because we have been making this point, and our state knows this all too well, that debt is consequential. That the notion of just sort of shedding all of this and saying, hey, we're Republicans, we cut taxes, that's what we do, don't worry about the debt questions, I don't think serves us well. You're going to hear a lot of debate around these factors in the next several months. Revenue neutrality, how is it scored, and so forth. But keep in mind those four themes. So here's in a nutshell what we're proposing. On the individual side, there's seven tax rates, and we propose to collapse those down into three. The top rate would be 33, the next rate is 25, and the bottom rate is 12. We propose to increase the standard exemption significantly, so you would subsume a lot of the things that are complicated and one-offs, deductions in the code, but you would subsume a number of those in that larger standard deduction. On the individual side, we would propose to eliminate the alternative minimum tax, the AMT, which hits my district hard and hits a lot of districts hard. We propose to eliminate the death tax. And we propose that investment income would be half of the rate of ordinary income. So if you're at 33%, your capital gains and dividends rate would be 16.5%, 25, 12.5, and so forth. Now, what's interesting about that is that under this proposal, essentially 95% of Americans would fill their tax return out essentially on something like a big postcard. They would not have to itemize. Can you imagine what that would actually be like? We propose to keep the mortgage interest deduction. We propose to keep the charitable deduction. And then below the line, begin to think through what would it actually look like if you wanted to create it, within the tax code, the types of incentives for retirement savings. What would you really want to build if you could build it from the ground up? What would you want to do as it relates to education savings? What kind of fungibility should there be between these accounts, if any? So do you see what I'm saying? I had a meeting with a restaurant owner part of a restaurant here in the Midwest, and they came in and they were talking about some minor things that they were concerned about. And I just stopped the discussion. I said, if you want to come in and talk about minor things, I will hear discussions about minor things. But let's not talk about minor things. Let's talk about making this so it would actually make us competitive. How about that? And then all of a sudden, the scales fell from their eyes, and they said, all right, we're willing to have that sort of discussion. Are those types of things possible? And that's the type of environment that we're trying to maintain within this debate. Okay, so that's on the individual side. How about on the corporate side? On the corporate side, we're proposing to lower the rate to 20%. We're proposing to move away from the international tax system and move to a territorial system. Okay, what difference does that make? Under the current tax code, we by and large have a tax jurisdiction in our country that says if you're a worldwide American company and you're making money overseas and you want to bring your own money home, stick with me, it's a taxable event when you bring your own money home. It's ridiculous. So what's happened? Money doesn't come home. Most folks that look at this have said there's between $1.5 and $2 trillion that's locked out. It's known as the lockout effect. So you've got an adverse tax regime, that is our tax code, that is keeping U.S. dollars from flowing. So what we're proposing is to deem part of that money that's currently out there repatriated at a low rate, and then transforming the system so that moving forward, there's no penalty for American companies to bring their own money home. Why should the U.S. tax code literally lock money out so that you say, well, we're going to put the factory overseas because we can use our money to put the factory overseas. And what do they do for their U.S. operations? They borrow the money here. Let's change that. So we're proposing to move away from that. We're proposing something called border adjustment. I need to take a running start with you on that. So let me, I'll come back to that. I need so much energy. And then we're proposing to transform the deductibility of interest. All of these things come together, and it's a revenue-neutral package. Now, if you're representing, if you're Rodney Davis and you represent Central Illinois, if you're Peter Roskam and you represent suburban Chicago, you represent a lot of small subchapter S LLC commercial entities. These are first and second generation companies, by and large, that are paying their taxes at the individual rate. So what happens? If we simply lower the corporate rate, they're not well served because they're paying at the individual rate. So what we're trying to do is to say, look, let's lower the corporate rate and the pass-through rate to the same proportion. And so what we're proposing is something totally new. That is to break out business income within the pass-through entities, and that would be at a 25% rate. So if you're a small business and you're making something and you're out in Carroll Stream, Illinois, and you've got 100 employees and you're currently taxed at the individual rate because you're the owner of the company, we're proposing to get that rate down even lower than ever before. So two things: border adjustments and interest deductibility. Remember, on border adjustments, the U.S. is an outlier, in my view, on many of these other tax jurisdictions around the world. We're out of sync. Most countries adjust at the border. They adjust their taxes at the border. Okay, what does that mean? That means if you're a German manufacturer and you're making something in Dusseldorf, and it goes through the normal production cycle, and it's headed through, they've got a value-added tax. The value-added tax is cumulative as it moves through. When it gets to the German border and it's going to be exported, they take the tax off. Good plan. It comes into the United States. We don't tax it. So there's no tax from that point of view, no equivalency in terms of the tax regime. Here's what happens if you're the manufacturer, though, in Carroll Stream. You're making something in Carroll Stream. The cost, because we don't have a value-added tax, the cost of your tax liability is cooked into your income tax. So we tax it at the income tax level here, and we don't adjust that at the border. Then when it goes into the foreign jurisdiction, it gets picked up there as well. So we tax it twice, and they don't tax it at all. And we wonder how it is that we're losing on this international scene. Now, it begs the question, how did it get this way? How did this happen? And it got this way, in my view, based on the de minimis tax that a value-added tax was when they first started out. And there was an agreement. Somebody agreed, hey, we'll just adjust these at the border. No big deal. And at the time, it was no big deal. But over a period of time, what has happened is a greater and greater imbalance. So what we're proposing is a border adjustable system. What we're saying is if something is made in the United States, then that as a product that's used in American manufacturing and so forth, that is deductible. If it's not made in the United States, if it's an imported good, then that is not deductible. It's controversial. It is consequential. We're describing it as removing the Made in America tax, and I think that's exactly what we're proposing. Now, the concern that I have is from some folks who come in and they say, look, I'm dealing with earnings calls every 13 weeks, and I've got to be on the phone and I've got to be talking to my investors every 13 weeks, to which I've replied to some of the CEOs, I don't know what that's like. I don't know what it's like to run a public company. I've never run a public company. And I will stipulate that you've got to be thinking in 13-week increments. But you know what? You don't want your policymakers thinking in 13-week increments. You don't. Your eyes tell me you don't. I know what you want me to do. I know you want me to be thinking longer term than this. You're thinking 13 weeks, and I'm going to retire in 3.5 years, and I want to check out, and I don't want my stock price down. I got that. No problem. However, you want your policymakers looking at this as a national inflection point, as a transformational moment to say, let's shed this old thing that's not working for us anymore, and let's embrace something that is far more buoyant and far more sustainable, because if we stay here, we will lose. And in the future, there's going to be a speaker that'll come in the future, who's warmly greeted outside, by the way. And a future speaker will be saying, oh, let me show you the PowerPoint. And it'll be click. When did this company leave? Oh, they left in 2018. When did that company leave? Oh, they went to Ottawa. When did this company? And you take my point. There is an urgency now. This is the time to get this done. And if we do it now, I think we will reflect back and say, you know what? On balance, it wasn't perfect, but it was good. And there is so many times when, as we know, the adage, the perfect becomes the enemy of the good. Let me make one final point, and then Jackie, with your permission, let's open it up. I think one of the phenomenon, so step aside from tax policy, and we'll get into, I'm sure, talking about a lot of other issues. There is a social science phenomenon that I think the social scientists are going to have a field day for in the coming years. And this is what is upon us right now, and we've got to sort this out all across the political spectrum. We have become instant gratification people. And I put myself right at the front of this parade, all right? So I'm not being sanctimonious. I'm not being self-righteous. But we're instant gratification people. And let me exhibit this to you. I have an expectation, not a hope. I have an expectation that I can go on my iPhone and I can click on an airline app. I can click and get a seat. I can click and get a ticket. I can click and get a boarding pass, charge to my American Express account. And if I get 15 seconds of that thing spinning around, I'm like, oh, this thing's junk. What loser made this? Okay, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And it has completely saturated us. I mean saturated us. Now, here's the challenge. We've got founders who understood human nature and didn't trust human nature. They had a very low view of human nature. And they were suspicious of it. And they didn't like the idea of power consolidating. It was mentioned in the introduction, I spend time with emerging democracies. I was just in Sri Lanka and Georgia and Kosovo. All of them, they don't have three co-equal branches of government. We've got this great gift. It's totally unique. Our founders rejected a monarchy, obviously, but they also rejected a parliament. You want to know why? A parliament is basically a legislative gang, where one faction gains control for a date certain, gets control of the executive branch, they control the legislative branch, and they basically do what they want. Our founders said none of that. Our founders created three co-equal branches of government intentionally and placed them in perpetual tension with one another by design. So, what's out of sync? Is the part that's out of sync the brilliance of our founders, or is the part that's out of sync a culture that has basically said, I want what I want when I want it, and I want it now? So my argument is we need to be cumulative in these things. We need to walk with these things. We need to have a discussion about these things, and then we need to act on these things. My predecessor was Henry Hyde, and I'll close with this. You're always good on it with a Henry Hyde line. Henry said this, there's one thing worse than gridlock. The worst thing than gridlock is the greased chute of government. And so toward that end, I'm not arguing for gridlock. I'm arguing for action, but I'm arguing for a deliberative approach that takes in as much feedback as possible, then makes a decision and acts. So with that, can we open it up for questions? Good. Thank you very much.
Hey, everybody. How are you doing? My name is Chris Roebling. I'm the treasurer of this august organization. And Jay and Jackie talked to me about doing the questions here with all of you this afternoon. And it's so nice to be with all of you nice people. You've got questions that are proliferating like tax carve-outs. I mean, this is... We could be here for 45 minutes, but we want to move through. So we're going to do a little bit of condensing. As they keep coming, holy moly, there's some fertilizer out there for questions. Okay, I'm going to start with one I think everybody is interested in. Betty Lou Saltzman of Mount Sinai Hospital, a member of the City Club, asks if Medicaid expansion is phased out of the ACA repeal bill, Illinois could lose hundreds of millions of federal dollars in funding. What will you do to make sure Illinois does not get financially hurt via the Affordable Care Act repeal procedure?
Betty Lou?
Betty Lou, Saltzman.
Betty Lou, I met with, I'm trying to figure out who Betty Lou is. There you go. Okay. Betty Lou, I met with a number of your colleagues who are also with hospitals, and they gave me some figures that I'll just try my best in my notes to reflect back. You know these numbers, and we met in my Barrington office, and the numbers are pretty staggering. That is, 650,000 folks in Medicaid and 390,000 people in the marketplace. That's in our home state. So here's what we're trying to do. We're trying to look at that question, and then we're also trying to deal with the constituents who've said, look, and I've got some emails that I'll share maybe later from constituents that have said, this is not working. This, you know, the premium hike is not working. The increase in deductibles is not working. So there's some people that have said, hey, just repeal the ACA and walk it away. Call that a day. That's the relief that people need. I'm not for that. I think that we need the type of transition that makes sense. But remember, at the beginning, Medicaid was on no great foundation when the ACA first passed. I was invited to participate in the Blair House conference that President Obama had. And if you're a C-SPAN person, you're the only person that watched it. It was not particularly exciting. But I posed the question to him, and I said, why would we, as a part of a transformation of healthcare, build in and put 20 million people onto Medicaid? That question was essentially dismissed, but that happened. So now as we're moving forward, I am of the view that that transition, states either need the money or the flexibility, but you can't be left ripshod, particularly as a provider. I do have a responsibility and a primary responsibility to my constituents who have said to me time and again, this is not working. The deductibles are crushing us, the downward pressure in terms of businesses is crushing us, the increase in copays is crushing us, and my inability to have access to any sort of care is really, really significant. I was down in Naperville a few weeks ago, and a young widow, mother of three, came to me. She said, I just want to show you something. And she showed me on her phone the premium charge that has gone up for her, and it was going up from, my memory was, $2,500 to $3,600 based on special needs that they had within their family. So the status quo is not working, which is why I'm not of the just jam a bill through approach. I think we need a lot more discussion on it, but I'm well aware of the tension that you're articulating.
We have a couple of pre-submitted questions here, and we don't want to forget those. Diane Johnson, a member of the City Club Congressman, asks, as a resident of District 6, when can I expect a town hall meeting in District 6?
I did one. Since I've been in Congress, I did one large town hall meeting, and it was miserable. People came in angry, and they left angrier. Nobody came in for a discussion. They basically came in to articulate. You heard last week there was a town hall meeting that was down in Florida. In Louisiana. Bill Cassidy, a senator, a friend of mine, a guy that I know, has a town hall meeting, and he opens it up with a prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance, and the prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance was shouted down, and there was a video that was, or audio that was released on people that had worked to try and take over the town hall and make sure that the production was not productive. What I have found to be a lot more productive than town hall meetings where people shout at one another is telephone town hall meetings. So a couple weeks ago, I had 18,000 people on the phone. Unless people thought that it was all sunshine and light, there was a lot of criticism that was coming my way. And let me just speak to this directly. So in 2016, I had 11 telephone town hall meetings in the district, 113 speaking engagements in the district, 147 other meetings, events, or award presentations, 107 other site visits to local businesses, hospitals, and nonprofits, 21 school visits, 30 roundtable discussions, and 74 other meetings. So there is a false narrative that's running out there, and if it's not that false narrative, it's another false narrative. But the House of Representatives is actually the entity in the United States Congress that is the flattest and easiest to get to. But participating in big circuses and other things, I just found not to be productive. And I think I represent a constituency that is longing for civility in public life. I mean longing for it. They don't want to hear the nonsense. They don't want to hear the acrimony. They don't want to hear the judgments. They want to hear solutions. And that's how I've tried to present myself.
David Marjal, a member of the City Club Congressman, asks, as you look towards tax reform and reducing rates as well as all of the structural reforms that you outlined, what do you see will be the effects for low and moderate income families?
So before I came, I had a meeting talking with some folks as it relates to just lack of economic opportunity here in the Chicago area and really all across the country. The past administration was the first administration that never had a whole year of 3% growth. And if you look in the past, dramatic decreases in economic growth that we saw as a result of 2008 historically have led to more dramatic increases. But we're now told that this level of growth, which is fairly de minimis and underperforming, we're told that's the new normal. Well, who loses when that's the new normal? You know, the phrase is, when the bulls fight, the grass loses. So the people who are at the lower end of the economic, at the economic rung, they're the ones that lose. This is not, you know, you don't get Nobel Prizes for observations like this. This is fairly intuitive. So if we're able to grow this economy and get it back so that it is growing again, what's the net result of that? Go back to the business owner in Carroll Stream. The business owner says, we're going to expand this facility. I was at a meeting a couple years ago in Carroll Stream, I think it was on North Avenue, and I was there, and there's a manufacturing operation. And I just posed a very simple question. They brought in about 75 people who were working the manufacturing line. And 75 people who are working for a manufacturing line in the middle of the day don't want to hear from a congressman. Okay, can I just stipulate that? So I realize I got to mix this up pretty quick here. So I just said, hey, I just got a quick question for you. Give me a show of hands. How would you all feel as the people who are working here today, what would you think if the company said that they're going to expand their operation and they're going to put another manufacturing operation right there? Who's for that? Every hand went up. Okay, what would you say if the company, instead of spending money overseas on a production facility there, they're bringing the money back here to do that? Are you favoring that? Every hand goes up. I said, all right, now, that's called repatriation, and you're for it. You just told me you're for it. And I'm for it too. Here's how we get this thing done. And so my view is some of these discussions from an economic point of view are made more complicated than necessary. I tell all the accountants and the CFOs that come into me, talk to me, I said, I'm on to you people. It's debits on the left, credits on the right, right? That's the whole thing, right? So I think in answer to your question, growth is the key. Growth is where the action is. Growth is the invitation. And it ought not be some central planning approach that tells people how they can invest, what they can invest. We need barriers of entry to be lower and then more opportunities along those lines. So growth is the key. And if tax reform doesn't lead to growth, it's completely specious and it doesn't produce anything like it should.
Thank you, Congressman. Another pre-submitted question, this one from Edwin Yonka of ACLU of Illinois. Congressman Roskam, can you say directly if you support or oppose the idea of a religious test for entry into the United States?
I'm opposed.
Okay. Alan Gaffner, Congressman Alan Gaffner of the Alden Network of Long-Term Care, says the proposed Medicaid reforms would result in catastrophic cuts to long-term care facilities. These cuts, coupled with Illinois' underfunded Medicaid program, would increase the federal action exponentially. I think the detriment is what he's talking about. How can you assist in protecting Illinois' long-term care providers?
I think that the essence of that question was around the same theme as it relates to Medicaid. And so Illinois is in a unique position. Some states did not expand their Medicaid populations. They rejected the money. Illinois accepted it under Governor Quinn. And so the notion of a smooth transition and making sure that people who have come to rely on a system still have a system to rely on is upon us. Now, that's not to say, however, that the federal government is going to be able to fill in every gap here in the state of Illinois. The solutions for the state of Illinois lie within the state of Illinois. And every other state around us has essentially figured this scene out, that is, creating places that are more competitive and more inviting from a business point of view. So lest this be shifted off on a federal responsibility, there's an appropriate federal role, and then there's sort of an inability of any federal largesse to come in and fill the gaps so long as Illinois is not able to fix its own situation.
Thank you. Congressman, Charlie Gardner, a member of the City Club from Roosevelt University, asks, will your new tax code require elected officials to release their tax returns?
No, I mean, this is the that's a matter for the election code. That's a matter for us as citizens to make those determinations. You're not going to have a tax code that's focused in on growth and simplicity and competitiveness and so forth and revenue neutrality, getting sidetracked with a large debate about who's a public official and all that sort of stuff. Public can make up its mind or the public can change that, but it's not going in tax reform.
Thank you. Congressman Mary Sheely, who is not a member of the City Club and actually says so on her thing. Mary, we would love you to join up, and if you just come up here afterwards, we'll take your check. Her question for you is, if, quote, we should be cumulative with these things, unquote, I think referring to your remarks, why not fix ACA instead of repeal ACA?
So that's a good question. The idea that the ACA just be left alone after the president campaigned on repealing it and replacing it, after House Republicans have voted dozens and dozens of times to the point where it basically became a punchline. How many times are you going to vote to repeal Obamacare? Apparently, one more time. It would be an insincere thing, in my view, to go and say, well, that was just a political line in order to win an election. Now that the majorities have been won in both houses of Congress and the White House, it's important to follow through on a campaign promise. The inverse would have been true. To somebody said, well, you're not sincere and you're not following through on what you planned. Now, that's not to say that there are not good things that we want to keep. What are the good things that have been largely discussed and are in every Republican plan? Making sure that people with pre-existing conditions are dealt with and that they have coverage, making sure that there's no lifetime caps, making sure that the younger people, 26-year-olds, are on the coverage and so forth. But so there will be a cumulative approach, I think. I was a critic of the way in which the last bill or the ACA was passed and that it didn't have that that feeling. Remember when Nancy Pelosi famously said that we've got to pass it so that you know what's in it. And set aside your opinion of the ACA. From a procedural point of view, it's not a good approach. It's an underperforming approach, and it left a lot to be desired. What we want to do is make sure that we avoid those mistakes.
Congressman, thank you. Laura Davis, a member of the City Club, has a pre-submitted question. Laura's with the League of Women Voters of Cook County. Comments from the new administration refer to violence in Chicago. As a congressman from the metropolitan region, what specifically will be offered to support violence prevention programs? Job opportunities directed to disadvantaged communities?
So I think part of the premise of this discussion is, why is Chicago unique? What is it about this metropolitan area that is falling to this type of violence? And this type of violence is heartbreaking. And this type of violence is having more and more of an impact, not just on the people who are subject to it and the families and the ripple effect. One of our own colleagues, as you know, had a family member who is victimized by this violence. But it begs the question, what is it about the city of Chicago that is dealing with this? Other cities don't have this kind of problem. And to say, oh, there's the three easy, snappy points to making violence go away in the city of Chicago, how thin is that soup? You know, these things, I think, are multifaceted and incredibly complicated and incredibly difficult. But I will say this. When somebody is predetermined, if you grow up at 3800 West Ogden and you're predetermined to go to Farragut West High School or one of those sort of schools, and you don't have the same type of opportunities that somebody else in a different zip code, that is structurally broken. That does not work. So I think one of the things that we've got to do is to make sure that students have more opportunity as it relates to educational opportunities. I mentioned a minute ago who loses when the economy is underperforming. Not people in this room, by and large. People outside of this room are losing when the economy is underperforming. So the ability to frame these things up, growth matters. The ability to expand opportunities matters. And I wouldn't be here, in some cavalier way to say, oh, there's this federal program, and if we only fund this line, then things are going to be great. They're not. This city has a lot of work to do. It has a lot of work ahead of it. It's a great city. And other cities are not subject to this type of violence. And so I think the city of Chicago needs to be looking around the country saying, what are other cities doing that mitigate against this?
Thank you, Congressman. I have a ton of questions here that get to your relationship with Donald Trump and your sort of view of Trump and his activities, which I've got Paul Karras asking, are the press in the back of the room the enemies of the people? I've got Brendan Sheehy asking, isn't it fiscally non-conservative to build a wall on the border with Mexico? So to sum up that big stack of questions here, I'm going to go to Matthew Wissa's pre-submitted question. How would you describe the relationship between the White House and the House majority?
The election night was interesting in that nobody anticipate Donald Trump's win. The media that was covering it that night, most of them looked like they were passing kidney stones, actually, and they didn't anticipate it. The Democrats, my colleagues, who I saw the next day or the next week when the House went into session, were flummoxed to the point of disorientation. Their view was, how could we have lost an election to Donald Trump? And they were completely flummoxed by it. And rather than reflecting on it, I think they've taken the position, listen, we're going to stick with our current approach, we're going to go with our current leadership, and we're just going to double down. Meanwhile, most Republicans, myself included, were surprised that Donald Trump won. So there's been this back and forth between Donald Trump, who is this figure who came in and essentially flipped the game board of American politics completely. I remember telling people, a year before he won, Donald Trump, he'll be done by Thanksgiving. There's no way he's even going to make it to the primary. And yet he obviously tapped into something. So now he's coming in, and this is where things like the blueprint that I described, he was able to talk generally about tax reform, for example, or generally about repealing Obamacare and replacing it with something else. But now, in my opinion, he's looking to the House of Representatives to say, all right, now let's get some meat on this bone and let's start to work these things through. So it's a relationship, you know, everything that you're reading is all true, basically. You know, it's a tumultuous relationship historically through the campaign. But then once he got into the White House, or once he won on Election Day, then it became very much trying to work back and forth and sort it out. That is to say, the Twitter phenomenon is all new. And there is a There is something that I've come to learn and to long for, and that's something called the unexpressed thought. How delightful.
All right, but we're going to express one more thought, and that's appreciation for Congressman Roscom.
Thank you, brother. Oh, yeah.
Don't go anywhere.